This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss a recent taxpayer class action brought against two California congressmen alleging complicity in genocide.
The lawsuit accuses these representatives of illegally misusing their authority to approve $26 billion in military aid to Israel.
We'll also speak with Professor Marjorie Feld about her book, The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism.
We will explore with Professor Feld how the suppression of dissent on college campuses today has historic precedent in earlier efforts to silence opposition to Israel's militaristic theocracy.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
On December 19th, 2024, a coalition of human rights activists and organizations filed an important class action lawsuit against California Congress members Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman. The lawsuit alleges that the representatives illegally misused their authority by approving $26.38 billion in military aid to Israel, despite evidence that these funds contribute to ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Supported by over 500 plaintiffs across Northern California, the case highlights growing public demands for accountability in U.S. foreign policy. It was filed by the group Taxpayers Against Genocide. At the core of the lawsuit is the argument that Representatives Thompson and Huffman ignored clear evidence of war crimes committed with U.S.-provided weapons, effectively forcing their constituents into moral complicity. Plaintiffs describe the profound emotional and moral injuries they've suffered resulting from their representatives' actions, emphasizing the legal and ethical responsibilities of these elected officials to prevent taxpayer dollars from funding human rights violations. The lawsuit seeks declaratory and injunctive relief, aiming to halt military aid to Israel and to secure accountability for decisions made in Congress, with plaintiffs ranging from seasoned activists to ordinary constituents. The case represents a significant legal challenge to U.S. military support for Israel amid increasing scrutiny over its devastating consequences for Palestinian civilians. Joining us to discuss this class action is Seth Donnelly, a Sonoma County resident, former Bay Area high school teacher, human rights advocate, and one of the founders of Taxpayers Against Genocide. We're also joined by Maria Barakat, a Lebanese-Palestinian anti-war activist, sociologist of law and society, and public policy expert specializing in equity from UC Berkeley. Both Seth and Maria are plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Seth Donnelly, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having us on, Heidi.
Seth, you're both a plaintiff in this lawsuit and also a key organizer. What are the central legal arguments on which the lawsuit against Representatives Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman is based?
Yeah, so the lawsuit, it's a massive class action that encompasses 10 counties, pretty much all of Northern California, and it brought together, you know, activists across these county lines. We have now over 700 members of the class, and then people like myself and Maria, who's also on the call, who are class reps from each county. Our fundamental legal argument is that even though Congress has wide latitude with its tax and spend authority, that latitude is not absolute. So Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution establishes that the tax and spend authority should be within what they call the interests of the general welfare and common defense. And that beyond that, even though, again, the courts have in subsequent cases given Congress wide latitude, they've also ruled that it's not an absolute latitude. We can find, for example, in 1968, the Supreme Court case Flass versus Cohen, where taxpayers sued over federal income tax dollars being used on private religious schooling purposes. And the court affirmed their standing to sue and actually, I believe, ruled in their favor in that case. What we are arguing is that just as Congress cannot appropriate and use our tax dollars to build private religious schools, they likewise cannot fund genocide. And the U.S. ratified the Convention on, for the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in 1988. Per constitutional protocol, when it ratified that treaty becomes binding for elected officials and federal officials to follow. And Article 3 of that treaty prohibits what they call complicity in genocide. So our position is that when Representative Mike Thompson and Representative Jared Huffman voted, those are the two reps in the different 10 counties. Thompson covers about half those counties, Huffman the other half. When they voted on last April 20th to send $26 billion more in military aid to Israel, they did so at the time when the evidence of genocide was overwhelming. And they did so after their constituents, like my high school students met with Mike Thompson face to face and said, don't do this in January. And he still did. Hundreds of constituents had appealed to them saying, don't do this. This is genocide. And they still did. And when they allocated our tax dollars in such a manner, they were violating their constitutional duty to follow the Genocide Convention. There's other aspects of our argument as well, but let me pause there to see what further questions you may have.
This is helpful because it answers a question I was going to ask. Is this lawsuit mostly symbolic? But indeed, it's more than that. Can you go into some details about the specific evidence cited in the lawsuit that supports claims of genocide in Gaza?
Absolutely. In starting, though, with the term symbolic, part of why this lawsuit is galvanizing so much support and participation in building the grassroots movement across Northern California is that it actually is going to the source, the appropriation, the tax dollars. So it goes beyond being symbolic. Many of us had spent the last year certainly participating in street protests, which we will continue to do and support, trying to get city councils to pass ceasefire resolutions. But at some point, we're like, we have to go to where the source of the appropriation power is. And our hope is that we do think we have a correct legal argument. Our eyes are wide open about the court system, but we do feel this is a very strong, compelling case that can, we're hoping for some sort of declaratory or injunctive relief that can then be leveraged by other districts throughout the country to really go beyond symbolism, but to actually successfully challenge how our tax dollars are being used. Now, in terms of the evidence of genocide, by April 20th, when they, along with other members of Congress throughout the country, voted to send $26 billion more, the 4 months prior to that, the International Court of Justice had issued its ruling that the case of genocide was plausible enough for there to be open international litigation, which was still proceeding and still is proceeding today. A month later in February, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch both issued findings that Israel was violating the provisions in that ICJ ruling, meaning genocide. They were violating provisions to protect the Palestinians from genocide. A month after that, in March, Francesca Albanese and the UN Special Rapporteur in the Palestinian Occupied Territories issued her stark report, Anatomy of a Genocide, that Israel had clearly crossed the line and was committing genocide. All these things had snowballed, along with many other reports that genocide was unfolding. And as elected officials, both Representative Thompson and Representative Huffman knew better. And it was their duty to no longer provide weapons and military aid to Israel in light of that genocide.
You referenced earlier possible prior success in a taxpayer lawsuit. What gave you the idea to file a taxpayer lawsuit? And indeed, are you aware of a body of prior successes?
We were inspired, like people all across the U.S. and probably the world, by the lawsuit that was filed in November 2023 by the Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestinian Families as plaintiffs, suing the Biden administration over genocide. And unfortunately, of course, that It was in January 31st of 2024 that the federal circuit court, I believe, the Ninth Circuit Court, ruled that they don't have jurisdiction to rule on foreign policy. So we disagree with that ruling, but what we see is different here is that we're actually going, we do have standing over how our tax dollars are directly being used. That's a domestic appropriation, and that our reps are the most immediate officials that are appropriating our hard-earned federal income tax dollars. So that's a different focus. We're not aware of a case yet that has come to the fore around tax dollars being used for genocide, but we are heartened by the fact that we do see a standing where taxpayers could sue over the unconstitutional use of their tax dollars when it came again to the FLAS case and breaching the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. This is new territory in the same way that the Juliana versus U.S., where the children sued over climate change, is creating new case law, hopefully. But we do believe we have a correct constitutional argument, and we're pressing forward.
Both important cases, and thank you for doing this. In a minute, my co-host Steve Rohde is going to be speaking with Maria Barakat, your colleague, in this effort. But before we turn to Steve and Maria, Seth, what are the main forms of relief that the plaintiffs are seeking from the court in this case?
Well, part of the argument, right, for us as a class, our class includes key Palestinian leaders in Northern California. It includes Jewish activists. It includes old and young. It's an extremely diverse grassroots movement that, and we've all branded together under the name TAG, Taxpayers Against Genocide. But in common, everybody in this class has been forced into being complicit in genocide. And that has resulted in moral injury and various forms of harm in different ways to members of the class. But everybody shares that in common. So in terms of relief, we're looking at three types. One is declaratory. We would certainly want the court to declare that this is in fact unconstitutional, the use of our tax dollars to fund genocide, and that then with that precedent, activists throughout the country, already were being contacted by people all over the country about wanting to do similar lawsuits. We'd also, we could leverage that relief politically and legally. The other type of relief is injunctive, that if the courts could say, instruct our representatives, they can no longer use our tax dollars since we, as a class, brought the lawsuit to fund genocide. That would be fantastic. The third type of relief would be financial in compensation for harm. And some of the harm is very real. Of course, it's nothing compared to what the Palestinian people have gone through. And our main focus is to stop the genocide in Palestine. But there is very real forms of harm, you know, that have affected people here in the U.S. and in Northern California, folks who've lost family members in Gaza, people who've gone through extreme psychic distress, mental health crises. And so if we get financial relief, which is what is part of the argument, then we're prepared to donate, and we will donate every penny to the Palestinian people.
Maria, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder. Tell us about yourself. What brought you to be a plaintiff in this lawsuit, and describe the kinds of injuries you've suffered as a result of the illegal funding of Israel that's alleged in the lawsuit.
Hi, Steve, and thanks so much for having us. I am a Lebanese and Palestinian American. I am a longtime Sonoman here in the North Bay in California in Mike Thompson's district. I am also someone who's been funding the genocide of my own people for over a year with my federal tax dollars. My great aunt Renee was from Palestine, expelled during the Nakba. Part of my family still lives in Lebanon, in our family home in southern Lebanon, and every day we wonder if they'll be blown to pieces or lose their home. And we are forced to fund, because our representatives have allocated our federal tax dollars to an entity, a foreign government that is conducting a plain and simple genocide. I was a teenager during 9/11, and I watched as the, quote, war on terror slaughtered thousands of innocent people all over the Middle East under false pretenses in the Bush administration. And now I'm watching a live stream genocide of my own people on my own phone for over 420 days, watching bombs drop on tents, watching children's small broken limbs and pieces of their faces being put into plastic bags, and listening to the screams of people burning alive, and watching people take their last breaths in agony on dirty hospital floors. There's hardly any words really to describe what it feels like to be experiencing this genocide from the outside, but also, of course, from the inside on the ground.
How did the coalition of now over 700 plaintiffs, as I understand it, come together? What's the movement behind this lawsuit, and what has motivated the involvement of such a wide range of plaintiffs?
Yeah, so in the North Bay, grassroots anti-war activists started organizing essentially immediately following October 7th, seeing the sort of unprecedented response of the Israeli military against Palestinian civilians. So many of the core organizers from Taxpayers Against Genocide are also members of Sonoma County for Palestine, members of the Mendocino and Bolinas, Petaluma, Marin, and Humboldt communities. We've started taking actions and hosting educational events together throughout this whole last year. We've built community together. We've spent months petitioning local government officials, city councils, boards of supervisors, and of course, petitioning our district representatives, Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman. A lot of us in Taxpayers for Genocide came together after a protest held outside one of Mike Thompson's winery fundraisers over the summer, and folks wanted to do more, so we started working together, doing the research necessary. As I said, building a strong community, one that is flourishing and becoming more and more powerful. But we're a broad coalition, as Seth said, of Palestinians and Jewish community members, anti-war activists, and we've come together as people of conscience, people who can't sleep at night, who have severe anxiety and have experienced hopelessness about what is happening. We're devastated in ways that we never knew we could be by this daily reality that we are living in as we are complicit in the genocide in Gaza. For many of us, the injuries are even more potent, as I said, as Palestinians having to pay for our own genocide. This genocide has been established by virtually every human rights organization on the planet as such. Even just recently, this month, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and Doctors Without Borders have all formally classified what is happening, what is being conducted by the Israeli government and the United States as a genocide in Gaza.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. So you've put these defendants, Representatives Thompson and Huffman, on notice. They know what they voted for, and many of the rulings you've mentioned have come before their votes. In my impression, they have no deniability. How have they responded, if at all, to your protests and demands that they not fund genocide?
It's a great question. It's been a really long year for a lot of us. Hundreds of us in our communities have called our representatives' offices, Mike Thompson and Huffman's various district offices. Some of us are even calling every single day for the last year. Some of us have spoken to their staff, and some of us have spoken to the representatives themselves and even been able to have meetings. We have been pleading with them directly through email, through phone calls, and demanding that they stop using our tax dollars for genocide in Gaza. And as you said, since the end of 2023, we have been demanding this as the United Nations was sounding the alarm that Palestinians were already, having already been under illegal occupation by Israel under international law, we're experiencing a genocide. And then in March, as Seth said earlier, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights reported that there was, quote, a reasonable grounds that genocide was being committed. And yet our representatives still said nothing. Whenever we've had the chance to actually speak to them, they've delivered a really boilerplate response about hoping for peace someday, about supporting a two-state solution, but always that the bottom line is that Israel has their full and unwavering support. The bottom line is that tens of thousands, and likely actually hundreds of thousands of people now, according to Euromed and The Lancet, are dead and massacred. And that is a reasonable use for our tax dollars. We of course reject that as a coalition. Huffman and Thompson have been made aware of what's going on and have continued to provide Israel with the weapons it needs to conduct this genocide with full knowledge.
So I'm getting the impression that the lawsuit isn't just a disagreement over foreign policy. You're alleging that this is illegal under international and U.S. law, as well as the Leahy Amendment. Can you tell us what the parameters of that are?
Yeah, so this is, as you're saying, this is not a disagreement over whether or not our representatives can vote on foreign policy. This is about a national issue. The U.S. Constitution restricts the U.S. from, you know, supporting genocide. We have the Geneva Convention, the Genocide Convention ratified in the United States Constitution. The Leahy Act is one that has been around for several decades that prohibits the use of federal funding for foreign governments that are conducting gross human rights violations. And all of those apply to this exact situation. It is what they are for and what they were created to protect against. And so our issue with our representatives is that they are misusing our tax dollars, that they have exceeded their authority by deciding to use our tax dollars in a way that supports a foreign entity to conduct human rights violations, genocide.
Tell us about Carol Bloom and Laurel Krauss, and talk about the significance of the role they are playing in this case.
Yeah, as I said earlier, our coalition is filled with extraordinary people of conscience, so many of whom have been working in human rights advocacy for decades or most of their lives. Carol and Laurel are two of those people. Carol Bloom is a progressive anti-Zionist Jewish activist in the North Bay in Jared Huffman's district, and she's been involved in peace building and mediation for years. She, like so many Jewish members of our community, believe that never again means never again for anyone. And the role of fellow Jewish comrades and activists is incredibly important during this time, as we are facing, you know, accusations, false accusations and slander about anti-Semitism, when in fact, we certainly want all people protected. And Laurel Krauss is the sister of Allison Krauss. Allison was one of four students slaughtered by the National Guard as she protested the Vietnam War in 1970 at Kent State. So Laurel founded the Allison Center to protect peaceful protest and commemorate her sister. She lives in Mendocino Coast at that center today, and she co-founded the Kent State Truth Tribunal.
Maria, thank you so much for all of that. Let's turn back to Seth for a moment. Seth, you referenced the 2023 lawsuit by the Center for Constitutional Rights as inspiration. How do you see this current class action, or how do you hope it might inspire others in the worldwide movement and the genocide in Gaza?
Well, I definitely, and all of us involved, we are hoping that this will spread across the U.S. so that the class ultimately becomes the people of the United States saying, you cannot use our tax dollars. This is illegal. And that there will be lawsuits across the U.S. Like, as I mentioned before, we're already in touch with attorneys and activists beyond our immediate two districts. We are seeing this as something that can be replicated. It's past time that we actually called out the source of the genocide, which is our tax dollars. That none of the horrors that Maria just described would be possible if we collectively had stood up and said no to Congress using our dollars to fund the genocide. You know, and the Nuremberg principles are clear that when a genocide is occurring, ordinary people have a duty to stand up and resist. Not just the leaders are not the only ones who are culpable.
Maria, this is a very important lawsuit. I'm thrilled that we've been able to have you join us so our listeners can learn more about it and can follow up on what Seth is talking about across the country. How can listeners support it, stay informed about the progress of the case, and in their own districts, how can they begin to foment the same kind of activism?
Yeah, thank you so much for covering this issue with us. I mean, I want to invite anyone listening to please email classactionagainstgenocide@proton.me and sign up for our mailing list. Again, it's classactionagainstgenocide@proton.me. We'll be establishing our website here shortly in the next few days, and we'll be able to release that to anyone on our mailing list. And please keep following us.
Seth, would you have more to add how people can follow the lawsuit or any final comments?
Sure. I just thank you so much for taking the time with us. We appreciate your work. As Maria mentioned, the email, classactionagainstgenocide@proton.me, that's the best way to get in touch with us as our website is under construction. We are setting up meetings with people across the country, and we would be more than and also activists and attorneys. So we're more than happy to create the space and the time to build this, such that it can become a national movement of taxpayers against genocide.
This has been a real pleasure to have you on. And we at Law and Disorder look forward to following the trajectory of this important case. So we hope to stay in touch with you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
On November 1st, when the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, for war crimes and crimes against humanity, Netanyahu accused the judges of, quote, anti-Semitic hatred toward Israel. When Donald Trump vowed to crack down on campus protests by invoking the Insurrection Act to enlist the U.S. military, he warned American colleges and universities that if they did not, quote, end anti-Semitic propaganda, unquote, they would lose accreditation and federal financial support. Today, one of the oldest and most virulent forms of hatred, anti-Semitism, is being weaponized as a cudgel to silence opposition to Israel's war against the Palestinians. If you criticize Israel, you are an anti-Semite. If you condemn Zionism, you are an anti-Semite. If an international court with 125 member countries dedicated to what Kofi Annan called the cause of all humanity accuses Israel, and it's important to note also Hamas military commander Mohammed Diouf, of war crimes, the judges from France, Benin, and Slovenia are guilty of anti-Semitism. The founders of Israel willingly took on a known risk when they established a Jewish state, choosing sacred religious symbols the Star of David as the official state insignia on the nation's flag, the menorah as the official state emblem, and Hebrew as the official language. In 2018, the Knesset doubled down by passing a law designating Israel the, quote, nation state of the Jewish people. The chairman of the special legislative committee that drafted the law described it as simply confirming the founding principle on which the state was established, that, quote, everyone has human rights, but national rights in Israel belong only to the Jewish people. The Adalah Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel said the law, quote, contains key elements of apartheid. During the hotly contested debate over Zionism in the 19th and early 20th centuries, anti-Zionists and non-Zionists repeatedly warned that establishing a Jewish state would pose grave dangers, not only to indigenous Arab inhabitants, but to Jews around the world. Today, that complex history has been largely replaced by an official sanitized version that doggedly erases the many Jewish voices that have sounded well-grounded alarms over the establishment of a militarized theocracy. To examine these important issues, we've invited Professor Marjorie Feld, the author of a new groundbreaking book, The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism. She is a professor of history at Babson College and the author of Nations Divided, American Jews and the Struggle Over Apartheid. Professor Feld, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your book offers new insight into a history that has frequently been buried or minimalized. How does your research challenge the typical narratives in the American Jewish community about our historic relationship to Israel and to Zionism?
Yes, this is a great question, and I appreciated in your introduction your reference to that history as sanitized, right, as having been partially erased, because the typical narrative in American Jewish history is really one of a triumphant history of this so-called consensus on American Zionism that emerged within American Jewish life. This was really a certain brand of American Zionism that marked unqualified support for Israel. And we were taught to think that any criticism of Zionism in Israel not only emerged as a force from outside of American Jewish life, but also was really damaging, in fact, dangerous to American Jewish security and to the security of Jews around the world. So my book is, in part, along with lots of other scholars and lay people, a corrective to that narrative. It documents criticism of Zionism in Israel and concern for Palestinian rights, as well as other concerns over this brand of American Zionism. And importantly, it marks that this criticism emerged first within American Jewish life. So what I really try to do in the book is to document the fact that American Jewish Zionists and anti-Zionists and non-Zionists, that they all were wrestling with questions about how to balance, you know, like deep concern for Jewish safety with a desire for a vibrant communal life. And they wanted to combine that with faith in America, American values, and also universalist ideas of human rights and equality. So I think it's important to note that all of these American Jews, both the Zionists and those who criticize Zionism, assigned different meanings to those values. And they were all part of these contests about what it meant to be Jewish and American in the, you know, beginning in the turn of the 20th century through to today. I think these are, you know, pretty universal questions about how to belong to a group and show what it means to belong to that group in your everyday life, but also walking around as a citizen of the world and balancing universalist values with that. So the book is really, I hope, about competing models of American Jewish priorities across the century.
Today, Jewish anti-Zionism is most frequently associated with the political left. In the early 20th century, that relationship was more complicated, with Jewish anti- or non-Zionism frequently, though certainly not always, associated with the community's German Jewish elites. Why did anti-Zionism especially appeal to some communal elites? And what might this mean for modern-day leftists looking for a legacy?
I think it's really important to note this early chapter in my book, which is indeed an early chapter in critics, American Jewish critics of Zionism and of this emerging so-called consensus, were very elite Jewish Americans. The emergence of their criticism of Zionism was in this early part of the 20th century, when there was real fear and precarity to American Jewish life, right? It was a really savagely racist and xenophobic era. It was nativist, anti-Asian racism. We're talking about the Jim Crow era. It was, and the debates were seen as having very high stakes because these elite American Jews, many of them of German descent, part of the American Council for Judaism, which was founded in the early 40s, they wanted safety and success for their families in the midst of this xenophobic era. They wanted to achieve and then, of course, maintain their elite status as business owners. And they also wanted to be proud American Jews. So I think it's interesting that their resistance to Zionism emerged from a sense of danger, the danger associated with claims of dual loyalty, right? That if you're loyal to a nation outside of the United States, that the United States polity itself, the people within the United States, will doubt that you're a good citizen, a good American. So they resisted Zionism mainly for that reason. And so in that way, I think it would be easy to dismiss these elite anti-Zionists, you know, as trying to maintain elite status, as really just trying to appear as good Americans. But when I went into the archives to do research on this group, I found that some of their questions are indeed enduring and might be useful to modern day non-anti-Zionist, modern day critics of the American Zionist state, for instance, right? They were really raising questions about who gets to speak on behalf of American Jews. Is it the people who have unquestioning loyalty to the emerging Zionist movement or those who are more critical? They were really wondering about the emerging Jewish religious schools and synagogues and Jewish community centers. Does Zionism and Jewish nationalism have to dominate and be the center of those curricula? They were really worried, too, about money flowing outward to Israel and not, you know, leading to a flourishing American Jewish community. So these are some enduring questions that emerged out of the elite German Jewish community. And I'll also say that my book, as well as Jeff Levin's really terrific book, Our Palestine Question, follows some of these elite German Jews who were in this council, this anti-Zionist organization in the 40s through to the 50s and 60s, when they really became concerned about Palestinian rights. And they were some of the only organized Jewish leaders to really show concern about Palestinians, what they would have called the Arab refugee problem in the 50s and 60s.
Marjorie, while you cite sources complaining about critics of Zionism being called anti-Semitic as early as 1937, there was clearly more room for different perspectives on Zionism in the Jewish community before the 40s and 50s. What changed in that era to initially lower, in your words, the threshold of dissent? And take a moment to define your concept of the threshold of dissent.
Sure. So a threshold is something after which, you know, there is penalty or punishment. And what I try to chronicle in the book is that in the 1890s and 1900s, as the global Zionist movement was beginning and took root in the United States, there was a high tolerance for all kinds of discussions about what centering Jewish nationalism might mean, about what a Jewish state might look like, about how American Jewish life might organize itself around the question of a Jewish state. And so there was a lot of dissent, as we would put it in, I guess, contemporary terms. Then, I don't have to tell your listeners or you that the Holocaust had just a monumental, devastating impact on Jewry worldwide. The destruction of the Holocaust in the eyes of many, many American Jews and Jews around the world called for unity in the face of trauma. And American Jewish leaders really called for unity and said that only through unity would American Jews and really all Jews be safe. So they saw in Palestine, which in 48 obviously became Israel, they saw a solution to the problem of stateless Jews and began to frame Israel as a place that would where Jews would always be safe. And so there was a very, very strong feelings in the face of this destruction and trauma that American Jews couldn't show the non-Jewish world any internal divisions. And I say this, and it's I continues to resonate, right? I can remember people in my grandparents' generation very fearful of showing any internal divisions, that American Jews must stand united. And so that became, in some ways, the rallying cry, the motivation, the underlying goal of unified consensus on American Zionism, on approaches to Israel. The stakes for safety felt very, very high. And so the threshold for dissent was really lowered, right? You have Israel allying with the United States in the Cold War. And so this alliance with Israel made sense geopolitically, even if anti-Semitism lost much of its legitimacy in the United States because of the Holocaust. A lot of American Jews still felt this keen sense of loss with all of the connections to the Holocaust and its destruction. So, you know, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you have American Jews, many of them, not all of them, getting college degrees, moving into the suburbs, building generational wealth. And Zionism and support for Israel really became, I guess, what we call a differentiator, something that made American Jews feel distinct, feel visible, stay mobilized, something to fundraise around, while joining, you know, white folks in the suburbs. And I would also add that, you know, the concerns that reform elite Jews, whom we already talked about, those concerns that they held close weren't really relevant because American Judaism and Americanism, they felt now was entirely compatible with Zionism. So all of these developments helped to make room for Zionist leaders who really emphasized this unity, and they called for a consensus to maintain their power, right, to gain even more political and economic power, to keep their community safe. All of these became the motivations for lowering the threshold of dissent. There were American Jews voicing concern for Palestinians who rejected the idea that unqualified support for Israel would keep American Jews and all Jews safe. And these American Jews were calling for, you know, more representative, more open communal institutions, broader conversations. So there were these continued contests of the priorities over American Jewish communal life. And I think that the book tries to highlight them in the midst of this quest for continuing quest for safety in the face of the Holocaust.
Marjorie, one of the interesting episodes you write about is the experience of Martin Blatt, a Jewish Tufts University student in the anti-war movement, who in 1973 taught a class called Zionism Reconsidered and caused a firestorm, attracting the ire of local Jewish communal bodies and the Anti-Defamation League. There are similarities between this and contemporary campus controversies, obviously. Can you tell us more about the Blatt Tufts controversy and how it compares to what we're seeing on campus today?
Sure. So one of the things to note about this book is that it took me about 7 years to write. So it was the research in the archives was pre-COVID, and leafing through the files of the Anti-Defamation League in the Boston archive, I found that Marty Blatt had this file. It was under the heading of Arab Propaganda and Anti-Semitism. And there was just so much vitriol around it that I was really interested and drawn in. And then I happily found Marty Blatt living in Cambridge, which is nearby to me and to my college. And so I engaged with him in sort of open conversations about what had unfolded and what the ADL had been tracking in 73. So I'll just tell you a little bit about what happened. Blatt came of age in the 50s. His grandparents were from Poland and Germany. He had a grandfather who died in a Nazi prison camp. And he was raised in a liberal Zionist family, very social justice oriented. But when he came to Tufts in 1971, he took a course with Uri Davis, who's a left political figure in Israel. And he started to see connections between injustice in Vietnam. He was already very active in the anti-war movement, and injustice in Israel-Palestine. He traveled to Israel in the summer of 72, and he was interviewing dissenters, people, Israelis who refused to serve in the military. And he actually co-wrote a book about this. But, you know, I think in our current moment, when we see college campuses really riven with debates and in some cases really cracking down over dissent on Israel, Tufts, after he took this course with Uri Davis at the Tufts Experimental College, Marty decided to offer a course called Zionism Reconsidered. This wasn't his first foray into Israel-Palestine activism. He had actually founded, I think this might also be interesting, a Hillel non-Zionist caucus. He felt, he and others, other Jewish students, felt that the Hillel chapter, which is, of course, a Jewish organization that rests on many college campuses, they felt it was too Zionist-oriented. So he formed a non-Zionist caucus, and Hillel expelled him and his friends from the organization for forming this caucus. But after he took Uri's course, he decided to teach his own course in the Experimental College, this Zionism Reconsidered course, and it really traced the history of Zionism. Some of the students in the class, they were all undergraduates, were Zionists, some were not. But he talked about Palestinian resistance, and he talked about Israel's Cold War alliance with the U.S. It was really important to him that he teach the students that anti-Zionism was not anti-Semitism. And he actually, you know, it was kind of a professor's dream. He got very positive evaluations from his students. And then in March, midway through the semester, members of the Jewish Defense League, which is a far-right anti-Arab Jewish nationalist group, they marched into Blatt's class uninvited, and they called it an anti-Jewish outrage. And so they passed out a flyer that said, not since Germany in the days of Hitler has any university dared to offer a course presenting a one-sided view of any national movement. One of the members of the group spat on Marty, and they actually had to call campus security to get them to leave. And following this incident, there were just huge debates in the Boston Jewish press and the Boston non-Jewish press. Mainstream Jewish leaders were alerted to this class, the Zionism Reconsidered class, and they urged the campus, they urged the Tufts president to shut the class down. Meanwhile, a lot of students were defending Marty's right to teach the class, and including many of the students who were in the class. So I went to the Tufts archives to look at the language of some of the letters that community members had written in the face of this incident. And it was totally apocalyptic language, right? They liken Marty's class, Zionism Reconsidered, to the destruction of the Jewish people. They see any teaching about Palestine as causing harm. They said it was endangering Jewish students, that it was endangering Jewish life. They called it an insult to the Jewish community. They called it propaganda. And the sort of biggest editorial which appeared in the Jewish Advocate was the Boston Jewish Press. The headline was Tufts Anti-Zionist Course Seen as Abuse of Academic Freedom. So there is sort of all of the conversations going on in the press, but most devastating, I think, was that during this controversy, Marty picked up the phone one day, and someone who clearly knew his family history in the Holocaust told him that his parents shouldn't have been saved. So there's all of these layers of connection to the trauma of the Holocaust in his story. And ultimately, Tufts decided to stand by his right to teach the class. He actually taught it the next semester. But he was really ostracized from the Jewish community, Marty Blatt, for teaching this class. And this uproar just sounds so familiar in our current moment, right? With all of the crackdowns on the encampments. And I think I would also say that the parallel can be found in the deep desire for young people to have access to knowledge about the history of Palestine, about the Nakba, the expelling and dispossession of Palestinians with the founding of Israel in 48. And my goodness, right now, you know, with concerns over how Title VI might be used to treat dissent on college campuses, which is to say, to what degree are we going to allow academic freedom to continue to thrive, to have students' needs for education on Israel and Palestine met? This is an enduring question, an ongoing concern. And this happened in 1973. So I think it seemed monumental to me in the moment when I found it, which was even before October 7th. And I think the ripples of this continue still today, even more profoundly in our current moment and as we head into a new administration.
We can only wish today's universities had had the courage to do what Tufts did back then. That's a very revealing story, Marjorie. You're listening to Law and Disorder with our guests, Professor Marjorie Feld. I'm Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. Marjorie, today we're seeing an unprecedented explosion of activism from Jewish leftist groups that are non- or anti-Zionist and critical of Israel, like If Not Now and the Jewish Voice for Peace. How does your research help us think about this current moment? Are there lessons these activists might learn from their predecessors? What are your current observations on the divisions in American Jewish communal life with regard to Israel and Zionism?
Right. Such a telling, important question. One of the themes that I really try to trace in the book is the cost of this low threshold of dissent. I talk a lot about how these choices made by American Jewish leaders to marginalize, defund dissenters from the American Jewish brand of Zionism, how it distanced American Jewish communal life from progressive movements or campaigns. I talk a lot about civil rights, but I think that's true of sort of anti-colonial campaigns in general. As Black and Arab and Palestinian Americans were joining these movements that criticized the Nakba, that criticized Israel's human rights abuses, and I'm speaking in the past tense here, a lot of American Jews felt, and you'll see this phrase again and again, quote unquote, forced to choose. They felt forced to choose between American Jewish affiliation with its unqualified support for Israel and support for these progressive movements, for anti-colonialist movements. And as a result, the organized Jewish world really dropped out of a lot of meaningful, lasting, committed memberships in some of these movements. So there was a cost to the lowering of this threshold of dissent. You know, if you look in the late 90s and the early 00s, you see that JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, and then, you know, more recently, If Not Now, took on positions where they're really trying to build up again, a Jewish left. They're trying to build up Jewish alliances with anti-colonialist movements, which I think are really central to dissent in American Jewish life, dissent to some of the forces that are ascendant right now, such as white nationalism. And so I think when now that we see JVP and If Not Now and so many other liberal and left groups showing up at synagogues in Jewish communal life, showing up on the American, you know, political stage, I think it's important that we're opening up conversations about dissent in the past so that these American Jewish folks can find role models, can recognize that there's always been dissent in American Jewish life, that it can't be simply, you know, dismissed or washed away as fringe. Because we have to take accountability for the fact that American Jewish organizational leaders tried to silence, took money away from those who occupied these positions of dissent. So I think there's a legacy there. They can look to that legacy. We can also build back up some of these coalitions working in really important progressive movements. I think those are all really important. And I'll just say that I think it's not incidental that these groups are very open to dissent on Israel-Palestine. In fact, they're sort of leading the way on this, but also they're really forward-thinking in terms of fighting racism and homophobia and classism and transphobia within Jewish communal life. So I see this as a really a grand opportunity for American Jewish life to take stock of this history, to invest in a sustainable future that fights these isms and becomes more inclusive, that shifts its priorities away from unqualified loyalty to Israel and really aligns with what we're seeing in the data as the position of younger people in the United States, Jews and non, which is a more critical view toward Israel and a wish to realize peace for Palestinians and Israelis both.
That gives us a positive approach to moving forward. Marjorie, where can listeners learn more about your book, The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism, as well as your ongoing research?
Well, I appreciate that. I always try to end on a positive note because I think there's this window of opportunity. Anybody is interested in the book, it's published by NYU Press, so their website is a place to look. I'm also a big fan of bookshop.org, so if folks want to purchase the book, that's a place to look. And, you know, there are places all around in JVP and If Not Now circles and social media websites to find information on these movements, broadly speaking.
Marjorie, one of the pleasures of doing this radio show and podcast is meeting people like yourself. I was so impressed by your book. Folks can find my favorable review of your book at the Marquez Review. We are very grateful for you joining us today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, Law and Disorder.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.